You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, November 9th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Daniel Nakanian, creator of What's on the Ballot, on the most important election results you may have missed from last week. Also on the program today, CBO score not expected for the full Build Back Better bill for at least a week. Meanwhile, Congress still facing a debt ceiling and a government funding crisis. Republican lawmakers look to punish the Republican House members who voted for the bipartisan infrastructure bill. More than 360,000 children under the age of 12 have received vaccinations. And the Biden administration is to seek boosters for all. Meanwhile, a federal court backs the United Airlines vaccine mandate. The January 6th committee issues more subpoenas to Trumpistas, including John Eastman and Jason Miller. Rest in peace, Max Cleland, former senator, vet, triple amputee, lost his seat when Republicans said he was like Osama bin Laden. New York Times wire cutter site. Workers threaten a walkout during Black Friday. Meanwhile, 800 Scranton teachers on day five of their strike. Lastly, Israel now using facial recognition software to track and surveil Palestinians in the occupied territories. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. It is Tuesday, or as we call it around here, Tuesday.
Day of twos. Twos, because it's the second work week. Work day.
Right, correct.
Yeah, twos, deuces.
Emma's here. She's drunk.
Yeah.
Emma Vigeland, hello.
Hello, Sam.
Just want to remind people, Emma, I'm not you. You remember this. But we, was it about a month ago? We had on a couple of, was it one or two representatives from a... from the New York City Taxi Workers Alliance. And at the time, we were talking to them about the incredible burden that they had. They were pushed years ago. They were sort of pushed and fed. It was almost predatory lending, providing them funds to buy, or I guess buy, New York taxi medallions, which is essentially like a license. Yeah, I guess the analogy would be a liquor license for a liquor store. And but the city provided funds so that they could jack up the value of the medallions for them. And then, of course, Uber came in and COVID came in. And you had taxi drivers who were stuck with hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt, each individual.
Even before COVID, there were multiple suicides in front of City Hall because cabbies were so in debt.
I
mean, because the city just basically gave away the farm to Uber, as has the governments throughout the country.
And they were looking for some form of debt relief, a cram down on these loans. And they had been engaging in a hunger strike for almost 2 weeks, I think it was. Well, just the other day, Bill de Blasio capitulated, agreed to have the city serve as a backstop for the debt that past administrations had essentially loaded onto drivers in this predatory fashion. It will allow the cabbies, some of whom, many of whom have debt that is well over $500,000. It will reduce their debts to $170,000 at most. Still an extraordinary amount, but at least you can conceive of being able to pay it off with the money that you're earning as a cab driver. The loan payments will also be capped at $1,100 per month. And so this is good news for the taxi drivers in this city. Wiping out the entire debt would have been better, but at least, you know, they have a fighting chance now.
And good of de Blasio. I mean, not good of, he should have eliminated all the debt, but it's important that this was done in the lame duck period.
Yeah.
Because Eric Adams is going to be less sympathetic to these kinds of,
one might imagine.
Yeah. Is my guess. I mean, he could prove us wrong, but not off to a hot start with his rhetoric right now.
Since we're on the topic of New York City and transportation, this was a sort of a fascinating, I don't know, glimpse into just how effed we are in this society. And the backdrop of this, of course, the concern about wokeness, the concern about CRT.
You're looking for racism everywhere.
You're looking for, you want to racialize everything. And this was supposed to be all over after the president was black. So yeah. Why are you looking for racism everywhere? And it is, you know, one of the things that we try and do on this program is to provide some historical context of some major themes in American history. But you should be aware that history is not a series of snapshots. That's not what history is. The way that we examine it can be, but there is a reality that exists. It is not chopped up into moments.
There's an inheritance.
There's an inheritance. And sometimes it's almost like you can't even, the inheritance doesn't just happen when one era dies. It is an ongoing inheritance that exists. Every second that emerges is embedded with the second that preceded it. And it is important to understand this history so that you can really assess what's happening in the moment. Because if you're not aware of what has happened in the past, your imagination for what is possible in terms of what is going on right now is severely limited. And it gets even more severely limited if you have people who are propagandizing and trying to change that past history. Whether it's Dennis Prager going, can you imagine if we treated the way that we treat the unvaccinated now, if we had treated AIDS patients that way?
He was saying there was no stigma associated with having AIDS.
It was, we'll go on and on into that, but it was way beyond anything that we're seeing today. Uh-huh. I mean, just by leaps and bounds.
Yes.
But he can say that because even though that was certainly within his lifetime where he was probably talking about how disgusting gay people were for having AIDS.
And you know, racializing it too.
In this country, we have very little historical understanding of where we come. There has been an ongoing project in this country to obscure certain realities. The lost cause. There was an entire movement built around obscuring the reasons for the Civil War in this country. So here's Pete Buttigieg, not necessarily my favorite person, an intelligent guy who for much of his career, I think has not used his intelligence in the way that I would appreciate, but facts are facts. And here he is, giving a speech at the, or I should say, a press conference at the White House. And I don't know exactly what he was referring to, but this concept that can infrastructure be racist? In other words, I think everybody understands that like a building is not racist in and of itself, but the way that it's designed, is slavery racist? It's just a thing. Doesn't exist. It exists, you know, as a generic thing. But slavery in this country was racist. And slavery is always wrong, but it was specifically racist in this country. Here's the talk. Play the clip.
As to where we target those dollars, you know, I'm still surprised that some people were surprised when I pointed to the fact that if a highway was built for the purpose of dividing a white and a black neighborhood, or if an underpass was constructed such that a bus carrying mostly black and Puerto Rican kids to a beach, or that would have been, in New York, was designed too low for it to pass by, that obviously reflects racism that went into those design choices. I don't think we have anything to lose by confronting that simple reality, and I think we have everything to gain by acknowledging it and then dealing with it, which is why the Reconnecting Communities, that $1 billion, is something we want to get to work right away, putting to work.
And apparently, like, everybody, he was expressing shock to how people reacted the first time he talked about it. Well, I got news for you. The third time he talks about it, he's going to express shock about the way that people reacted the second time he talked
about
it.
Total conniption.
Yeah. We don't want to think about this. We don't want to think about this.
It wasn't even like that. It was even more clueless than that. It was like, you idiot.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Of course, liberals seeing racism in every corner of society.
He was speaking specifically about the machinations of a guy named Robert Moses, who was, I think he had like a dozen different, I don't know how many different titles he had in New York, but it was basically public works, city, you know, Department of Parks. I can't remember.
Czar of moving around, I think.
Yes. And Robert Caro wrote the sort of the definitive biography of him, although I don't even think there was any other biography. But
Power Broker, yep.
And this was a very popular book back when I was in my 20s and 30s. I don't know when it was produced, but I think it was around there. I mean, I think I read it around college.
It was in the 70s, I think.
Okay. But it became very sort of, people became much more aware of it, it seemed to me, around that time. And Moses was apparently, according to Caro, one of the most racist people I've ever met.
He basically drove chauffeured around in New York being racist and figuring out how to ruin neighborhoods with highways and stuff.
Robert Moses was reportedly, when he was involved in building public pools in the city, making pools for black Americans colder than ones that had that white people had access to.
Also from this book, I think.
Yes, same book.
And apparently he also felt like, look, you can pass laws, but you can change those laws. But what you cannot change as easily is concrete.
Mm-hmm.
And read the, do we have the passage?
It's right here.
Yeah, I got it here.
Can we put it up too?
Yeah, I'll read it. Underlying Moses' strikingly strict policing for cleanliness in his parks was Francis Perkins realized with shock, deep distaste for the public that was using them. He doesn't love people, she was to say. It used to shock me because he was doing all these things for the welfare of the people. He denounced the common people terribly. To him, they were lousy, dirty people throwing bottles all over Jones Beach. I'll get them. I'll teach them. He loves the public, but not his people. I'll skip a little bit ahead here. Now he began to take measures to limit use of his parks. He had restricted the use of state parks by poor and lower middle class families in the first place by limiting access to the parks. So not just racist, but classist, I just add there. By limiting access to the parks by rapid transit, he had vetoed the Long Island Railroad's proposed construction of a branch spur to Jones Beach for this reason. Now he began to limit access by buses. He instructed Shapiro to build the bridges across his new parkways low, too low for buses to pass. Bus trips therefore had to be made on local roads, making the trips discouragingly long and arduous. For Negroes, whom he considered inherently dirty, there were further measures. Buses needed permits to enter state parks. Buses chartered by Negro groups found it very difficult to obtain permits, etc., etc.
This is the way that you segregate societies without having to put up a sign saying that society is segregated.
Just like you can be racist if you don't, you know, scream racist expletives. They make it the bar, they make the bar really low on purpose in order to clear themselves of any wrongdoing.
Well, they make it about individual bigotry and not structural, like,
yeah,
policies.
And there's nothing more structural than our infrastructure.
Right, and this whole, like, playing coy about this, we all know what wrong side of the tracks means, right? Like, this is, we all have a common sense awareness that these sorts of grand decisions do have implications for people and like, political implications.
And we have redlining.
The point is, with the wrong side of the tracks, same thing with the way they did the highway system, very much so in the 50s and whatnot. We're going to segregate the city by putting literally a barrier in the middle of the city. So we will cut the, you know, I-290 will go through these neighborhoods here and make sure that it's very difficult for you to cross over from the poorer section very often, maybe the black section of a city, into this other section, the white section. And this, and the way that you set up public transport, I mean, we just had this happen, I don't know, 5-6 years ago with the
look at the subway map. Compare
the Atlanta, yeah. The Georgian, what do they call it? The whatever the Georgia transit system was to go out to.
Was it BART?
I don't know. I think that's San Francisco, oh. But out to Cobb County and to the stadium for the Braves, because they didn't want to allow poor people, and very often people, these stops also in black neighborhoods, to get to the game.
I mean, this is a big thing in sports in general, putting the stadiums way out in the suburbs. Atlanta Hawks basketball team had a thing where they're like, are we getting a little bit too... The owners, I can't remember exactly what they said, but they were anxious about the demographics of who was showing up at their basketball games.
And does that mean that the stadium itself is racist? I mean, come on. Yeah. Do you really... You're like a child.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Braves stadium might be a little racist.
Well, that's true. Yeah, right. Inherent in the name.
Yeah, but Tomahawk Shop.
But, I mean, this is... the grown-ups understand this. We will talk about the child who doesn't understand it later.
Well, Tucker and Joe Rogan and all those types.
Right. Right. This idea. And we can go back. You can see this in the things, you know, in some instances... It's not necessarily... The intent isn't necessarily to be racist. And there also can be racism. There's racism embedded in our tax code. Go back and listen to the interview with Dorothy Brown. It's simply because of the way that our system works.
But I mean,
where the political power is shapes the nature of our society. And so if you have a segment of the population that has been historically denied political power, and that can be both on a class basis and a race basis, then the way that the city or the state or the nation is structured, both in terms of physical and non-physical infrastructure, is going to reflect the desires and the will of the people in power, which means it's going to necessarily disadvantage people who have been out of power.
Just focus on what the Rogan types and the Tucker types choose to naturalize and what they're curious about. They're deliberately incurious or uncurious about, like, these historical facts that we can print out and look at in front of our eyes. They don't want to learn about that, but then they can conspiracy theorize about, you know, I don't know, DMT when it comes to Rogan or January 6th when it comes to Tucker.
I will say this. I think you've described Rogan to some extent. But Tucker Carlson knows.
I know.
He is just a bigoted liar, period. Rogan may be a little bit ignorant in specific areas, or a lot ignorant in specific areas, and listening to the wrong... Tucker knows exactly.
And he likes it.
What he's doing.
He likes the way
this is. He is a fabricator.
Yeah.
All right, folks, a couple of things. First off, don't forget... January 6th.
January 16th.
January 6th is going to be 10 days before January 16th this year. It's going to fall on a 10 days before, like it always does.
Yeah.
And on January 16th, we are going to rush the Wilbur Theater
yes.
in Boston, Mass. And you can join us. You can get into our secret cabal of planning by going to Majority Live and buying a ticket. Mm. And we will send you instructions on how to get there and what we're going to do.
In invisible ink.
In invisible ink. And then we're going to hang...
Make a scaffold.
We're going to make a scaffold. So check it out. Majority Live to get your tickets. And today's program brought to you by one of my favorite sponsors. That's right. Sunset Lake Sabadee.com. Use the code LEFTISBASKET, 20% off. Folks, I will tell you that there are two main things that I've been using Sunset Lake Sabadee for. Four. One is to sleep.
I used it last night, the best sleep I've had in weeks, because I've been so stressed about this like apartment search I was been doing. It's finally over. Sunset Lake Sabadee knocked me out. Feeling great.
Number two, I will also sometimes use that tincture or a gummy bear when the kids are being particularly difficult. I'm sorry, that's just the case, okay? Also, I realized that in summer, first blast of summer, first couple of blasts, I get some eczema. I've been using that Arnica, and it's really for muscle rub, but that's what I used it for. And the fourth thing is I give it as gifts. I give it as gifts. People love this stuff. And Sunset Lake Sabadee is not like, well, I don't know. I'm sure there's other places somewhere around the country that must have this level of integrity. But they have their Sabadee assessed by third parties that give you a full breakdown of everything that's in there. So you know you're not getting junk. They also use integrated pest management. They don't use pesticides. 100% organic fertilizer. And they have a whole array of great products. Gummies, fudge, coffee, hand rubs, smokables, Keefs, Smalls, pre-rolls. And they're a great company. $15 minimum wage. Mostly employee-owned. They support strikers. They support people in their community, Afghan refugees. And we're going to do something with them in the coming weeks. Just a great company all around. You will not be sorry about this one. Sunset Lake Sabadee. SunsetLakeSabadee.com. Use the code LEFTISBEST for 20% off. Okay, want to welcome back to the program the proprietor of the What's on the Ballot, like, aggregate. I don't even know what to call this. It's a one-stop resource for everything you could possibly want to know that is being voted upon in upcoming elections and follow-up. Daniel Nahanian, welcome back to the program. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Daniel.
So people knew about the top line, you know, obviously the governor's race in Virginia, I think the governor's race in New Jersey, and I think there was some awareness, too, of what was going on in Minneapolis. There were a lot of narratives built up from these, which we would have no way of testing but for other elections that take place. So we can see the will of people as they're reflected. And in some ways, some of these elections are more narrowly tailored to these issues than something like, you know, like the governorship. So let's dig into this. You have a piece that was in, I guess it was in Politico, the most important election results you missed. Let's go through some of these, and you can tell us why they're important. There was a lot of local elections that took place on that Tuesday. Let's just start with with the war on drugs. There's been a lot of pushback, and on some level, it also just sort of like makes you wonder, like, why aren't the National Democrats doing more on this? Like, it's such a gimme.
Over 80%, I think, of Americans approve of legalizing cannabis recreationally, and Biden could do that with the stroke of a pen, but he hasn't done it.
So, Daniel, walk us through where some key places where this, you know, the war on drugs has fallen apart.
Yeah, I mean, that's already a great framing, Emma, because it seems like Washington, D.C. is still, as in the federal government, is still debating cannabis and the smallest steps on cannabis. Joe Biden obviously ran against legalizing marijuana, though he said he would reduce criminal penalties. Whereas the rest of the country and voters seem to have already moved way past the conversation on cannabis. States like Michigan, South Dakota, and other red states and past years have already legalized it through referendums. And what's interesting is that in local elections and referendums, the debate, the conflicts are more about what to do with the war on drugs more generally already. So perhaps the most interesting referendum on this issue on last week was that Detroit decriminalized the possession of mushrooms and psychedelics. And that's also building on a trend that started a couple of years ago, places like Ann Arbor, Washington, D.C. at the local level, and Oregon have taken similar steps. And it passed by a very large margin. And what we've seen elsewhere in prosecutor races, more specifically in places like Austin last year, Philly this year, Virginia prosecutor races had the same conversation this year. We're seeing a conversation about whether the criminal legal system should step back overall from prosecuting, from going after drug possession because of the harm that the war on drugs has really created around the country. And the fact that it hasn't actually produced results in terms of substance use and so on. And so that's a very interesting contrast of DC can't even get its act together on cannabis, and the conversation elsewhere has moved on to a bigger, bolder conversation already.
And I think it's indicative of the Democrat. I mean, look, this is such a gimme, such an obvious political benefit for Democrats with a whole host of people. But I think we are watching like a perfect example of how ossified the leadership is in the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. Putting aside from an ideological standpoint, just in the sheer politics here, they're not doing this because they're afraid of the backlash from a cohort of conservatives who are never going to vote for them anyways. And I mean, there's no other explanation, because if you wanted to slow the roll of this happening from the federal government, you could do affirmative things to keep this from happening on the local level. Yet they're just basically staying away from it because they don't want to be implicated. They are perfectly willing just to let it happen on its own and then just be fine and let it go away, because they're bad at politics.
I'm going to give you another example that really didn't get a lot of play this year, but I thought it was a fascinating thing that happened in 2021, which is that in the spring, the Washington State Supreme Court struck down the laws that prohibited drug possession in Washington State. So from one day to the next in Washington State, drug possession writ large was legal. And Oregon had just done something similar last year in a referendum of decriminalizing drug possession and trying to move away from the war on drugs, from the idea that the tools of criminalization are the solution to this, to addiction and substance use. And Democrats there recriminalized drug possession in the spring through a state bill at a lower level than before, but still, like, the conversation within the Democratic Party hasn't embraced the fact that there's a lot of voters, including in nearby Oregon in that case, that want a different set of ideas, a different set of solutions to substance use issues.
Yeah, it really is amazing, because it would be, I don't know. It seems to me it would be a huge boon around the country. So also, you mentioned there was a lot of decriminalization of marijuana in Ohio towns as well.
So I was just saying we've moved beyond cannabis in some state, in some contexts, but there's states like Ohio where at the local level in parts of the country that we don't associate with, obviously, Democratic strength. We're seeing pushes locally in places where the state isn't taking care of it for voters and at the local level to take matters in their own hand and change local ordinances around cannabis. And we saw that in Ohio last week. Yes.
In Kristen Sinema, I wonder what this really does say for Kristen Sinema when you start to see this type of, and I guess it's possible to read too much into this in terms of what's happening with politicians, because we saw this in Florida too, but, $15 minimum wage.
Yeah. In Tucson, Arizona, which is a very large city and kind of the base of Democratic politics in many ways in Arizona, because of its size and its blue nature, voted to increase the minimum wage by a very large margin. And it's really, as you were saying, notable because the state senator, Kristen Sinema, voted against increasing the minimum wage earlier this year. We have all seen the famous video where she thumbs down the minimum wage increase on the floor of the Senate. There is clearly conflicts within the Democratic base, and we have seen that in many stories. There's a lot of resentment and anger towards their positions. And there isn't in any way an obvious jump from the fact that there is an initiative like this to a primary campaign. But it will be very, very interesting to see, how that continues. In many cases now we have seen, voters take matters in their own hand on the minimum wage. It's very low around the country and initiatives are trying to fix it in place after place.
How much of an infrastructure is built around specifically that type of initiative, right? And I ask because it's not hard to imagine that a lot of those people who were motivated by Kristen Sinema voting against it came out and, you know, if I'm an organizer and I'm on, you know, and I'm planning to maybe primary Kristen Sinema or get involved in that, I get a bunch of names of people who I know are committed activists to this type of stuff. I ask both because, like, you know, and maybe it's distinct in each area, but Democrats in Florida seem to be a complete disaster in terms of their organization skills. Yet $15 minimum wage passed there.
Yeah.
And I wonder if around referendums like this, there can be built alternative or parallel institutions or organizations or networks that can be activated in other contexts.
Yeah. One thing that's, first of all, the difference between a primary in Arizona potentially and the general elections that Democrats are losing in Florida, there's a difference in turnout and the importance of organizing in each of them. What's interesting about Sinema is that she's sort of doing this on issue after issue, right? Like the minimum wage, immigration, taxes for the very, very wealthy. Like on every issue, they could be coalitions of organizers willing to prioritize the 2024 Senate race if this continues, right? You're absolutely right, right? It creates infrastructure. In some cases, it can correspond to an infusion of national attention and money for local groups. We really saw that around Amendment 4 in Florida, where a lot of specific money went around rights restoration a few years ago nationally that otherwise would not have gone. Referendums kind of connect those local groups, and there was a coalition of local groups in Tucson that I'm going to blank on the names right now, but obviously if you're interested you should go check them out because they did amazing work in putting that on the ballot and getting it passed.
There has been a rise, it feels like, in things like participatory budgeting. Mm-hmm. Will you tell us, A, what that is, and then it passed in Boston?
Yeah, no, it's definitely very interesting, and that will depend always on the particular place and the people there. That is sort of the point. But the point is to take a slice of the city budget, and create a process around which the residents of the city through proposals, meetings, and consultations, and occasionally votings can shape where that money goes. So, for instance, Seattle has spearheaded some form of participatory budgeting, and they actually had cut the police funding a bit in 2020, and some of that money was allocated to the participatory process for Seattle residents to help shape where the money would go instead of the police. So that was a process that was still ongoing the last time I checked. So in Boston now, a slice of the budget, not a huge slice, but some of the budget will be put in that category as well. The new mayor, who's a progressive, who's one of the success stories for progressives, I think, of the election last week in Boston, had also endorsed the measure, even though technically takes away some of her own authority over the budget. She endorsed it, said it was very important for racial justice and equity, and so that is something that will be interesting to follow in the coming year. It's a bit of a slow process.
So we've talked about drug prohibitions dropping around the country, and there's also been a lot of stuff, despite the fact of what we heard about in Minneapolis, more attempts at police reform that came from really different angles, ranging from budgetary to oversight organizations, and then also in terms of local courts, in terms of criminal justice. Can you walk us through those?
Yeah. There's always so much to decipher on criminal justice because it's all at the county level and the municipal level. And obviously so many different narratives, some of which go against sort of the one election story that has been proposed as well. So you mentioned Minneapolis. I think that was the top line election in terms of what people see, which was very important. It was a proposal to replace the police department with a department of safety that was going to combine some of the functions of policing with other functions that would be given to non-armed city employees.
I've been corrected on this, that it would allow for that change to happen. It wouldn't have necessarily imposed that change. It would have amended the charter of the city in such a way that could happen.
Okay. The rent control measure in Minneapolis also went that passed. Also, is an enabling measure, and the city council probably will sit on it anyway. But the other major conflict around policing was in Austin, Texas, where the city council cut some of the police funding last year in 2020, and there was a major push by the right in Austin to reverse those cuts and actually increase the police funding and lock Austin into a higher police force that would have been harder to walk back. And that measure lost by a very large margin, I think 2-1 almost last week. So that's sort of the mirror image of a refusal to increase police funding and actually reverse the police budget cuts. And then there were a lot of other measures, a lot of prosecutor races, a Cleveland initiative to increase the oversight over the police with a new board passed very easily. Mayoral races had a lot of debates around policing and the budget of the police. And progressives lost a number of those races, again in Minneapolis, again in this time in Seattle, but also in some of the places that where some candidates were proposing a bolder vision of reimagining safety and sort of using similar language around that we saw some activists use in Minneapolis, like in to some degree Michelle Wu in Boston. Those candidates won, and this. On policing, it's always a major fight between the police union and the police officials that lead the police departments. and what voters actually say. So we have seen over and over again when oversight commissions have been introduced either by councils or by voters, we've seen the police union fight those over and over again, occasionally block them through the court or trying to try their best to make them inoperative. And that's so like on these issues, the day after the election is really so important because the police are able to sort of block these reforms in many ways and not abide by them. And the municipal government system is not equipped in terms of political will to a great extent to respond. So that's going to be something very interesting to watch in Cleveland, for instance.
In the past, we've talked to you about key sheriff races and their relationship to ICE. Were there any of those races this time around? Where are we in terms of how immigration policies are executed?
Yeah, things haven't changed immensely when it comes to immigration enforcement in terms of the relationship between local law enforcement and ICE and the conflicts, the organizing around that. That was one of the major areas of progressive wins during the Trump era, getting local law enforcement, often Democrats that were just collaborating with ICE as though it was the most usual, the very routine thing to do, were being defeated as that issue rose. There wasn't so much an issue in 2021, just based on where the elections were for these offices. But you know, these offices, the sheriffs have a lot of different roles and different hats. So one, for instance, hat they have is to manage jail conditions. And, you know, jails in the U.S., a lot of places are mostly catastrophic, squalid conditions with a lot of death inside jails. We are seeing that in New York right now with Rikers is in a state of crisis. And we had some elections like that in New York and New Orleans. Actually, the election is in 3 days. It hasn't happened yet. Four days on over the weekend. There's an election there where in New Orleans, where the jail, which has been under a consent decree with the federal government for so long, has become a political issue. And you know, on the one hand, it's dispiriting to see the conditions in which people live be an electoral issue because it's a matter of basic human rights, basic human decency. It shouldn't be up to voters to decide whether someone is going to die in jail or not based on the conditions. On the other hand, it's not like we are seeing in these places where these officials have been in power for 10, 20 years without really electoral contestation, with just maybe an appointment or elections that are uncontested. They don't care. No one cares about what's going on inside the jail. And these elections are providing some opportunity for people who do care to put these issues on the table and force people to look at what's happening in the jail in places like New Orleans or elsewhere.
All right. So lastly, let's talk about school boards. I think we've covered in New York State the absolute dismal failure of the election reforms. There was a good constitutional amendment that basically said that people have a right to clean air and clean water in the state, which is going to be very helpful in the context of civil suits against polluters. It's going to be very helpful in the context of what needs to be proven before you start to, I don't know, whatever it is, dig or build a factory or whatever it is, because the burden of proof is going to shift in a lot of these instances. That's all well and good. We had massive failure on expanding access to the ballot. I mean, not even expanding, just making it easier to vote in this state. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, other than it was just an abysmal failure by activists, by the people promoting it. I had barely any awareness of what these ballot measures were, which is shocking because, I both should be more aware. Personally, I should have done a better job, but also, like, how did I not get an email about this?
I've gotten so many DMs from strangers, messages over the past week people who live in New York who feel anguish, some of them, that they themselves may not have thought of flipping over the page of the ballot to remember to vote on the initiatives. There was almost no ad campaign, no efforts by the Democratic Party in New York to support those amendments, make sure they get across the finish line. Whereas conservatives, especially upstate, were running ads and making the presence felt of opposition to, again, as you said, very baseline amendments that would have enabled same-day voter registration and no excuse mail voting. Those are things that exist around the country in many, many states, and that failed by a very large margin in New York. We also know that very large chunks of New York City voters didn't fill, who actually went to the polls, didn't fill those questions, which, you know, if you don't know what a referendum question is, if you haven't seen anything about it yet, in the moment, it can be a lot to decipher and know how to vote. Yeah. So the failure of the communication there is really abysmal. And New York's Democratic Party has gotten a lot of flack over the years for not prioritizing voting rights. And this was, you know, adds a chapter to that. And, you know, the head of the Democratic Party was busy going after India Walton, the Democratic nominee for mayor in Buffalo, was running against the write-in bid by the incumbent. So he had time for that, but as far as we see, he had he didn't have that much time or money or funding to spend on these very important initiatives in New York. Yeah,
let me put a finer point on it. He didn't want it. There's no doubt in my mind that the chairman of the Democratic Party in New York State did not want to increase access to the ballot. Mm-hmm. They did not want that. And I'm also convinced that they weren't terribly concerned about the 63 senators, too, because, you know, people forget. But Andrew Cuomo desperately was looking for as many Republican senators as he could, even if he had to sort of like take Democratic ones and turn them into Republican senators. I mean, there's a lot of corporate interests in this state, and there's a lot of, you know, incumbency protection that's going on here. And so and that juxtaposition between write-in candidacy to defeat India Walton and to prevent the expansion of ballot access, those are this, you know, two sides of the same coin in New York State. Really, just.
And you know, across the river from New York, the same issue in New Jersey of same day voter registration, which again exists in a lot of places around the country, but hasn't passed in New Jersey, again because of a Democrat there, because the state Senate, the head of the state Senate in New Jersey was opposed or had blocked or stalled the bill that the governor was pushing for same day voter registration. Now, as you may have seen, the head of the state Senate in New Jersey lost last week, one of the Dems who lost, but that loss actually opens up room for a bunch of progressive hopes in New Jersey, because there was a lot of conflict between the head of the state Senate there and the governor, and the governor won and the head of the state Senate didn't.
All right. So let's talk about CRT and school boards and whatnot, right? I mean, so much of what we've heard out of Virginia was ostensibly about those issues. And I think there's an argument that there was a capitalization on the frustration that a lot of parents felt in terms of school shutdowns, masking, this and that. I personally think it's perfectly justified to feel frustration about it, but that it, I still also think it was the right thing to do. COVID sucks. Being in a pandemic sucks. Having to take steps to avoid the communication of a virus sucks, but I'm not going to elect some frickin' lunatics to take over my school board because of it. Where were we on that? To the extent that there were, how many races were there where that became an issue? To the extent that we can tell, and how did they turn out?
That's the quantification is hard. There's so many school board elections, like hundreds and hundreds of school board elections were on the ballot last week. What was very interesting is that the right did make a major effort kind of throughout the country in places that, you know, I could list, but are not necessarily like known. They're not necessarily like big cities or places that people know around the country. And that's really where the fight was for the right. And trying to take over as many of these very, very local school boards as possible. You know, in some places it's at the county level. In some places, a county has 25, 40 school boards. And there were a lot of money being poured in from conservative, a lot of money by the standards of school board elections, I should say. A lot of money being poured into places in Pennsylvania, in Colorado, kind of as a statewide project. In so many school board races, conservatives who like supposedly were angry about critical race theory and indoctrinating children, and just in general about race and racism being addressed in these schools. And so while it's not possible to do like an overall like summary of numbers here, you know, what is interesting, especially given how prominent that story is in terms of how we understand Virginia, is that In at least many of the places that I had made a note of prior to the election as places that were particularly high profile in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Connecticut, New Mexico, Colorado, Pennsylvania, the right often lost. There was no conservative wave in those offices. Definitely they progressed and snatched some seats here and there for sure. But many of the incumbents were the most observed in the states I just mentioned, won and often not by that tight a margin. So that kind of creates a contrast, right? Where like, in the places where this was the most debated, where there was an actual conservative offensive that tried to get the general public to care about critical race theory and want to stop the discussion of racism, those efforts didn't succeed. Now that doesn't mean that wasn't actually a very good tool for the right to energize its base, drive up its own turnout even more than happened on the Democratic side. And that you know, conversations of racism and wanting to like make a stand on that didn't help the right in higher profile races. But again, it is important because this is where the right has built its local power before at the school board level, right? In the past during the Ray Reagan era and so on. So it is important to note that these elections that happened last week as well.
Yeah, I want to put a finer point on this. The idea here is it seems to me is multifold for people who promote. The reason why you would pour money into this if you're the conservative movement, if you're some millionaire, billionaire, whatever it is because A, when you're talking about statewide elections, you could be bringing otherwise non-voters out because they're particularly pissed about the, you know, teaching kids that slavery existed in this country. And so they come out and they wouldn't otherwise come out, and they're going to vote for the other Republicans up and down the ticket, even though that they're there specifically because of a small race. And it seems to me you're also message testing a little bit. If you're these organizations that are handing out this money, you're also building email lists for potential activists in the future. I mean, the value of contesting these things, and I would also imagine you're doing these a lot more often than not in states where they're going to come into play in on your elections, general elections, presidential elections. You know, what was it, four states where there was a margin of maybe 60,000-70,000 votes, which had gone the other way. Joe Biden loses the Electoral College. I mean, it doesn't take much. If you can bring out a couple, you know, a couple thousand new voters because they're pissed that their town in Pennsylvania, you know, the school board wanted to have masks, you know, that's 2,000 new voters that you've activated.
And we did actually see that last week in Pennsylvania specifically, because they had a state Supreme Court race in Pennsylvania. It was the only state Supreme Court race last week, and the GOP won by about a point only. And unlike in Virginia and New Jersey, which had a lot of, it was obviously a very large swing, Pennsylvania's election did come down to the fact that in Philly there was much less turnout comparative to past years than in a lot of the rest of the state. And you know, a lot of the rest of the state, Pennsylvania was probably the place where the right really put in money in those local board elections, including in the Philly suburbs. And they lost a lot of these races, not all, they lost a lot of these races, but that, as you were saying, energized a lot of voters, and that may have swung a seat for the state Supreme Court.
We should say, you know, it just reminds me, like, you know, we want a big seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I guess it was in the spring of 2020, and largely because Bernie Sanders stayed in the primary. A lot of people are saying, you know, why is Bernie Sanders staying in the primary? Bernie Sanders does not stay in that primary in Wisconsin. That seat goes to a Republican without a doubt. And so people need to understand the strategy that exists here is very often not just about the specific seat that is being contested, but up and down the ballot and through time going forward. Daniel, this is great work. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. Where can folks find you? Obviously on Twitter, and where else?
So I'm on Twitter. You mentioned that I was running the What's on the Ballot.com project. I'm also preparing work on a new project that I'm still being cryptic about, but I am excited to tell you more about it in the coming month at some point.
All right, fantastic. For now, we'll just call it cryptic.
Yes.
Dot wherever.
Cryptic teaser.
But we will put a link to your Twitter account so people can follow you. As always, really great stuff. Really much appreciated.
Good to talk to you.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Folks, going to head into the fun half.
Yes, we are.
We're going to have Nomi's going to join us.
Join in now, actually.
Oh.
Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show, you support the free show. And you not only get that, you get the fun half. And you not only get, we're just working on the mechanism to get some other bonus content. But like, you know, when we, for instance, you know, when we go for Thanksgiving, we'll probably have a day or two where we don't have a free show. But members will get probably new content. Mm-hmm.
Very
from
fancy.
Where? From whence will that come? We don't know. Don't know. Not going to tell you. Join themajorityreport.com as well. And again, Majority Live, if you want to get a ticket for our insurrection at the Wilbur Theater.
January
16th.
That's right.
Oh, we had the same idea. Yeah,
January 16th.
That's how you can remember it.
There you go. Nomi!
Hey, what's up?
What's happening on your show?
Well, today we have a really exciting show. We're going to be talking about movement fatigue and reassessing our strategies given the election results, given how much we lost with the infrastructure fight with Joshua Kahn Russell. He, of course, works in the movement space, works with organizations on addressing internal dynamics and movement energy. And he's going to be giving us his professional thoughts, which is a big deal. And of course, he did a lot of work over his career in the environmental movement as well. So it's going to be a really interesting show. That's tonight on rockfin.com/Nomi Key. If you are not a member of Rockfin, you can go check it out there. We also started off on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/The Nomi Key Show. And we have a full week of shows. It's crazy. If I were to go through all the guests, I think it would be too much, but we'll be tweeting it out. So fun stuff. And patreon.com/The Nomi Key Show, as usual, if you want to do audio and get special stuff.
Did we talk last week?
Yeah.
I can't even remember. Like, well, I guess it was Tuesday, so we didn't get the results.
No, we didn't.
Okay, because I was just mentioning with Daniel Nakanian about the abject failure of New York activists to promote the voting referendums. I mean, it's a real
talk a lot about this because we wrote that initially at the Unity Reform Commission and then pushed it on the New York Democratic Party, and it was their job to implement it and they refused to. Then they took it to the legislature, didn't have the majority then, and then it turned into this, but it was in the
Let's talk about it in the fun half. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
Yeah, brand new episode over at Literary Hangover, The Adventures of Colonel Daniel Boone by John Filson, 1784, goes into...
Charge.
It's a seminal text in the Daniel Boone mythology, which comes actually in the second chapter of a pamphlet trying to attract settlers to Kentucky. And it's like, here's an example of how this is done, and it's going to take a lot of fighting. So that's Daniel Boone. Learn how he first heard about Kentucky as an Edenic promised land and then left Kentucky, promised to never go back again because he was indebted and being sued all the time by people there. So patreon.com/literaryhangover to support that show, but it's available on the podcast feed.
Did you have a raccoon hat?
Well, no. Famously, Daniel Boone actually didn't like to wear coonskin hats. He was more—he wore different types of hats. But
what kind of hat?
Where did that myth come from?
Deer skin. But the coonskin hat comes from television.
Naturally.
Yeah. Really?
Yep. He kind of looked down on coonskin hats. Actually.
This is part of the reason why I'm always nervous to listen to your podcast like this, because it just shatters
the myths
that I've been holding on to. What does a deerskin hat look like?
I'm not sure if it is a deerskin hat, but I know that he didn't wear coonskin hats.
He didn't wear them, or he just sometimes found them uncomfortable because they were itchy.
He didn't wear them, and he looked down upon them.
Right. He looked down upon them.
Lower quality fur.
Oh. Don't tell them about the ratskin hat.
That sucks.
We're all going to be wearing them soon, guys. Don't worry. In the apocalypse.
Back to wearing animal hides?
Get comfy. Yeah, after we eat rat, we're going to take the skin. And that's Francesca Fiorentini's line. She's like, prepare for your favorite recipes for roasting rat over the fire.
Oh, jeez. What are you guys talking?
You'll be done by then, Sam. Don't worry.
Yeah, it's true. That's true. That's true.
Is it Femme Friday or Prepper Friday?
I'll be a...
Both. Women are always prepared.
I'll be a distant memory at that point. Folks, going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. You can IM the program by picking up our app at majorityapp.com. See you there.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird.
No way!
Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow. But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.